We are back.
Y'all.
Okay, I know that this isn't written on our notes, but I just want to talk about it very quickly.
Oh, no.
I just want to discuss Oprah for a moment.
Oh, okay.
I don't
What are we talking about?
That she should run. And I think that Twitter's reaction to it was wild. It was
wild. This is not my idea, but I saw it on Twitter, and I think it's a great idea. I think she should just buy Fox News.
Sure. That's a great idea.
That's awesome.
Isn't that a really good idea?
I just think that people were talking about Oprah when she made a great speech, but I think there's a couple things. If Oprah runs for president, then we lose Oprah to comment on the presidency. And two, if you are looking, if you are hankering for women of color that are in politics,
there's
Kamala Harris, Tammy Duckworth, Maxine Waters. Jeez. Yeah. We need more.
I mean,
but it's just ridiculous.
Well, no, because the precedent here is just that Trump is a celebrity himself, so he got in the office, and all because The Rock had even said at one point he wanted to run, and then everyone's like, "Oh my gosh, Oprah!" Like, listen, we don't need any celebrities in the White House. Like, I know everyone's like, I don't want the politicians. Like, no, get the people that know what they're doing, that understand foreign diplomacy, and help us in and out of our borders, and then we'll be fine.
Yeah.
But it's like we've swung really far.
Yeah.
To be like, fine, you had a celebrity, we have one too.
Yeah. And listen, Oprah's dope.
Yeah. No, I love Oprah. I think she's a dream.
But she's awesome. But we always talk about how some people can be more effective when they're not in the presidency
office.
Or when they're not in office. You know, so. Oprah would be someone that we should just have on the outside that obviously she's extremely smart, intelligent. She knows what she's doing. She's socially conscious. So like, let's use the influence that she has in other realms.
I saw people on Twitter like evoking Obama, and they were like, Obama didn't have that much experience. And I was like, dude was a constitutional law professor.
Yeah.
And a senator for a brief bit of time.
So what?
So anyway.
Anyways, shiny objects, but also we love Oprah. Huge
we do
fans.
Love Oprah. We are. If she wants to come on the pod, we'd love to chat
with her.
We'd
love to chat
with
her.
She had a great speech at the Golden Globes. More men could have said literally anything.
But, you know. We have a great interview today that is super timely. We have the co-executive director Emiliano of the Women's March Los Angeles, which is next weekend.
Yes, Emiliana Guareca.
Yes. We're very excited to have her, so stick around. But till then, let's jump into
Russia.
WTF happened this week.
Yes.
So Dianne Feinstein, brave, wonderful senator from California, released the interview transcript with GPS Fusion, or Fusion GPS, rather. They had the transcript. This was the transcript from Glenn R. Simpson. He's one of the co-founders of Fusion GPS with the Senate Judiciary Committee. Chuck Grassley, who is the Republican senator from Iowa, had been keeping this from being released. And
shocker.
Glenn Simpson, I believe is in the Washington Post, wrote an op-ed basically saying that Republicans are covering this up and they're only releasing certain things. We covered this, I think, last week. And then Dianne Feinstein, was just tired of it. And so she released it. And I think, and it's amazing. And in this Washington Post article written by Devlin Barrett and Tom Hamburger, they say that the transcript of the Fusion GPS co-founder Glenn R. Simpson's interview with the Senate Democrat over the objections of Chairman Charles E. Grassley was released. And then Feinstein's action comes alongside an effort by Republicans to discredit the dossier as a politically motivated document that the FBI has relied too heavily upon in its investigation. Feinstein sought to push back against the perception and to bolster the FBI's credibility. And in the op-ed that Glenn Simpson wrote, he said that the dossier corroborated info that the FBI already had. I think that's really important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The FBI hasn't been using the dossier as a roadmap. They've been using it as a piece of corroborating information.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's just interesting that they want to shield our eyes to these things when, but I'm glad that someone, you have to have someone with a gall like Senator Feinstein. It's good that she did this. I think it's, again, transparency is key, especially in situations like this.
Yeah.
And so I'm happy that she did it. And again, it's not like she unveiled new information. Like, these are all reports that have been corroborated now. So it's like,
yeah, Also, there and there's information coming out. So originally, the dossier was funded by a Republican who was running, I think, a Republican group that wanted to get information on Trump. And then the Democratic National Committee, I believe, got involved, or was it a Democratic group. Fusion GPS was hired in mid-2016 by a lawyer for Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. Mm-hmm. So people are going to jump onto that. If a dossier finds damning material, that doesn't delegitimize who paid for it. And opposition research happens in every fucking election.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. So it's just, it's a bullshit excuse. Yeah. It's infuriating. Moving on. So Trump's lawyers are anticipating that Mueller is going to have a request to interview him, and they want a limited scope.
I want him to be interviewed so badly.
Well,
hours.
He gave a.
And I want to be there, and I want to just soak it in, and just figure out all of the things he's pointing back to that are wrong.
Can you imagine?
Or like, you know, he's contradicting himself and everything.
He would incriminate
else
himself. I guarantee you, he would just say the thing.
Yeah.
And
he incriminated himself in that CBS interview.
I truly find it hilarious that, like, his people, the president's legal team, has been preparing for this expected request for months. This is from the article from CNN with written by Gloria Borger and Pamela Brown.
I love that.
And they say this president's legal team is preparing this expected request for weeks. Trump's lawyers have said they are hoping for the investigation to wrap up quickly. However, sources insisted there have been no substantive talks or active negotiations yet about a potential interview with the president. But the fact that they're already talking about wanting to limit the scope is like, you're continuing to look more and more guilty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's all they do. Yeah. Everything they do.
So just let it rip. Just walk in and just do the interview so we can just ask you the questions.
But is this not any different than, like, you pad the entire room so the toddler doesn't electrocute themselves?
They're babysitting him
because they know, like, they can't just leave him to his own devices to have this interview. Like, they know he'll, like, the cracks will show and literally this entire thing will fall apart.
Yeah, yeah.
The best is that this article quotes, in June, Trump said that he would, quote, 100% is willing to testify under oath about his interactions with the former FBI director James Comey. 100%.
Yeah, he said that. I was 100%. Watching that. I think it was in the Rose Garden. Oh. And he was like, I'll do it. And it's like,
and his whole team is like, no.
Yeah.
It's like all the whole team like is in like slow mo. Like,
you can hear a quiet cry every time he speaks.
Yeah.
Yep.
That staff.
Anyways, so stay tuned for that. We're looking forward to seeing if it happens or not.
And if you're wondering, it gets worse. So Joe Arpaio, the controversial sheriff pardoned by Trump, has entered the Arizona Senate race. Joe Arpaio, this is a CNN article also by Eric Bradner. Joe Arpaio is the Republican former Maricopa County sheriff known for his hardline immigration tactics, and he says that he's running for Senate. Representative Martha McSally, the preference of national Republicans, is in the race to replace retiring Republican Jeff Flake. She's also set to enter the race this week. And conservative Kelly Ward, who I think is the Trump pick. Arpaio said that he has a lot to offer. He says, I'm a big supporter of President Trump. He says that I'm going to work hard. You don't take anything for granted, but I would not be doing this if I thought that I could not win. I'm not here to get my name in the paper. I get that every day anyway.
So you are here to get your name in the paper if you say things like that.
Yeah. So this is, I was curious. I wanted to know more about Arpaio, and there's a GQ article written by Jack Moore that kind of talks about things that he's done. So Arpaio hasn't been sentenced, but when he was pardoned, he was facing up to 6 months in jail after being found to be in contempt of court for refusing to follow a federal judge's order. And the order was that Arpaio couldn't be bothered. In the article it says, and what was the judge's outrageous order that Arpaio couldn't be bothered to adhere? And that was to stop arresting people based on the fact that they look Latino and therefore might be there illegally. Arpaio's jails were so brutal that more people hanged themselves than at jails pretty much anywhere else. And that's just considering deaths that were ruled suicides. In the Phoenix New Times report, nearly half of all deaths in Arpaio's jails were simply not explained. The staff in Arpaio's jails would often not be willing to allow inmates proper medical attention, and this includes pregnant women, one of whom lost her baby due to the negligence of the jail staff and then had a guard protest when the hospital let her see her dead child before the funeral. Arpaio's SWAT team once conducted a raid on a house expecting to find a weapons cache or cache, only to have gotten the wrong house. They burned the house down in the process and forced the family's dog, which was trying to escape, back into the house to be burned alive. So
he's, and if you need anything else to accentuate that fact, He boasted that his proudest accomplishment was the creation of a 7-acre outdoor jail he called Tent City. All right. And in this, like, they were the inmates were forced to such terrible conditions. In sweltering summers, the temperatures could get anywhere from 115 to 120 degrees. They would have to sleep in tents in that. They would strip down to their underwear. They had no cold water, only water from vending machines. And they had to pay for those things. You know, like, this is not a good person. This is not someone that should be holding any kind of office or be in charge of any kind of police system.
No.
He's a danger to society, and he needs to be locked up.
Yeah, so look up Kyrsten Sinema. She is running. She's the Democratic challenger against the Republican field.
Mm-hmm. And also, there's a really interesting...
Emily just raised her hand.
I did raise my hand. I just I didn't know what to do. And we didn't move on until I said this thing.
Sure.
So there's an article in the LA Times that was published on January 14th called Former Arizona Sheriff Joe Arpaio is Back. So too are Latino voters who helped oust him. And it's a really good article. So look this article up in tandem with learning more about Kyrsten. But essentially there's this 20-year-old who's just like a killer community organizer, Yenny Sanchez. She thought her work was finished. She was spared from the threat of deportation by the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, which we talk about later. And she campaigned to oust Joe when he unsuccessfully ran for sheriff. And so she thought she was good. But she says, quote, in this article, if he thinks he can come back and terrorize the entire state like he did Maricopa County, it's not going to happen. Sanchez, 20. I'm not going to let it happen. And so it talks a lot about her work getting Latinos registered to vote and actually getting them out to vote. And so keep an eye on this like killer 20-year-old nailing it.
Also, this is from an article from The Week. A record-breaking 31 House Republicans won't seek re-election in 2018. That includes Daryl Issa of California, who is the worst person. Most significantly, this is from the article, Republicans in states won by Hillary Clinton are leaving in droves. So Democrats only need 24 seats to take back the House. Right now, I think generic polling has them at a plus 11 or plus 12, which would lead to like anywhere between a 40 to 60
seat switch. But that doesn't mean we can't let up.
That's the reason it's polling so well.
That is our famous thing. Yes. Is, oh, we're good. And
no,
then
we are
don't.
Not good.
We are not good until it is official.
So just, you know, again, check out Swing Left. Check out Indivisible. Get involved with these groups and vote. Vote, 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 vote. It is paramount that you do. Let's go to DACA.
Mm-hmm. So this Hill article by Rebecca Savronsky, the White House transcript fails to include line from Trump on clean DACA bill. So this is a very interesting thing. So last week, President Trump, he had made these comments on immigration, and in the transcript of that meeting, the White House failed to include a line from the president regarding a clean bill to address recipients of the DACA program. So he told Senator Dianne Feinstein.
She's just making trouble this
right,
past
she's
week.
She's ruffling all the feathers.
We're very proud in California.
But she asks, at one point you say, how about we just do a clean DACA bill with promise to talk about immigration further later? And Trump says, and it's on tape, yeah, I would like to do it. And then you watch Kevin McCarthy's eyes dart over across table to slowly interject... quickly interject over the president to redirect him to go back to what they wanted. And for whatever reason, the White House decided to just completely take that part out of this video.
And it was on camera. It was on camera. Mm-hmm. I'm astounded. I'm continuously astounded.
And again, like, because I don't know why this White House doesn't think we don't have technology or television or any kind of sound.
I don't know.
But we can see these things. So a White House official said anything left out of the transcript was not done on purpose, according to the Post, and that the conversation's context was clear. The White House later sent out a corrected version of that transcript.
So that was bad. Obviously, not good. Today, Trump came out and said that the program that protects immigrants who were brought to the U.S. illegally as children is probably dead, casting a cloud over already tenuous negotiations just days before a deadline on a government funding deal that Democrats have tied to immigration. That's from the AP News, written by Darlene Superville, which is such a cool name.
That is such cool.
Darlene, I was writing and I was like, Superville?
If you want to come on the pod, Darlene, we'd love to have you.
President Trump tweeted, DACA is probably dead because the Democrats don't really want it. They just want to talk and take desperately needed money away from our military.
Which is just...
not great.
A very
awful,
confusing incorrect sentence.
Yeah, and he wants to tie DACA and the continuation of DACA to funding for the wall, which will not work. It's a bloated, useless thing.
I also don't care that they decided to decrease the size of that wall. Like, you know, they're making all these modifications. Like, this should not be a priority.
This is actually wasted time.
Yeah. So you can look online. I mean, we did a past interview with Juan Escalante, who is an undocumented person who was had DACA. And he is wonderful to follow on Twitter and to get involved. You can check out United We Dream. That's another amazing group. If you want to get involved with that or donate money their way. Mm-hmm. Shall we move on?
Yeah. Yes. This whole back and forth.
Shithole?
Oh, yeah. So we avoided talking about this whole time.
I was like, how?
I know, we didn't lead with shithole.
I know. But,
I honestly feel like we can just do this quickly because it's like, why in the good God's name? This is even
just
coming out of his fucking mouth.
Because obviously at this point, everyone knows we're talking about the fact that...
that he's a racist?
Yes. Well, he's definitely racist. President's absolutely.
Racist.
Yeah. So Trump, he... In the Oval Office, apparently, so again, this is one thing where we don't have audio of it. But
of course.
In a meeting, he discussed about the protection rights for immigrants from Haiti, El Salvador, and African countries as part of a bipartisan immigration deal. This is a Washington Post article by Josh Dawsey. So Trump says, quote, "Why are we having all these people from shithole countries come here?" He said, according to these people, referring to countries mentioned by the lawmakers. So he suggested that the United States should instead bring more people from countries such as Norway, whose prime minister he met with on Wednesday. What? You pick. So first of all, you say that all these countries that have been through natural disasters, that are experiencing some of the worst conditions possible, mm-hmm. that are experiencing modes of slavery still. And he calls them shithole countries and says then... noticeably that the country that we should be bringing people from is majority white.
Well, that's and I think that's the big issue. I think he said shithole mm-hmm. and people were up in arms about him saying shithole. And I get it. That's
not a great way
to describe Africa as a continent.
Yes.
That being said, I think the bigger issue is that he talked about those nations and said, why are they coming here? And then offered up a majority white nation.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And this is the same guy who has said on both sides,
regards to white supremacists.
Yeah, this is the same guy who opened up a full page ad in the New York Times about the Central Park Five after they were proven innocent. This is the same guy who has said in one of his books that he doesn't trust when African Americans were counting his money. He'd rather have Jews do it. I mean,
And also, it's a lot. And that in tandem with, you know, I think the 24-hour news cycle, which we bring up having a love-hate-hate relationship with, you know, that we're going back and forth on, did he say shithole? Did he not say shithole? Did he say that? Did he not say that? No one was, mm-hmm. this person was in the room, that person, whatever. Like the specifics of what he said, at this point is neither here nor there. It's just another representation of that like severe racism that mm-hmm. we've seen from him since long before he was like even in the running.
Yeah.
But an interesting article that did come out about this was in the New York Times by Julie Hirschfield Davis, titled "A Senior Republican Senator Admonishes Trump, America's an Idea, Not a Race." So this is a senator, Senator Graham from South Carolina.
Lindsey Graham
said, again, quote unquote, allegedly, no, you know, we talk about who's in the room and who's not, that America is an idea, not a race, in response to his comments. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that's really the only positive thing I've seen come out of this, aside from everybody freaking out of whether or not shithole is a bad thing to say, which obviously it is. Like,
obviously
we know that.
Yeah.
we don't need to just keep talking about what he said because we already know this.
I keep thinking when you said the room, I kept thinking of the room where it happened from Hamilton. Except instead of the creation of the Constitution, it's the degradation of a continent. So,
how long have you been working on that one?
Past 10 seconds, but I'm pretty happy with how it came out.
Okay, good. Good work.
Job.
But I think the point here being that, if anything, we need to help these places.
Yes.
What he calls a shithole place. Like, no, they're amazingly proud people that come from those areas.
Yes.
But they still need help. So how dare you try to distance yourself yet again from communities of color
mm-hmm.
that desperately need the aid of a place like America.
And they were talking about immigration policy. So that's people coming into the country. That's
right.
Not even talking about like international relations, mm-hmm. but obviously comments like this is going to send out a huge reverb into our like quote unquote reputation, which I don't even like, what is that now?
I think too, there was something on Twitter, which I saw, which I think very profound. There was a firefighter who I think he was of Haitian descent. I'm not sure. But he was one of the firefighters in Brooklyn a couple weeks ago that died running back into the fire to save people. Mm-hmm. And people kept pointing to him as an example of, you know, an immigrant from another country, from an African country, coming in and doing an amazing thing. And that's absolutely true. He did something amazing. Yeah. But what this person on Twitter tweeted, which I thought was very profound, was we do not have to continuously sound the exceptionalism of immigrants. Yep. Right. In order to justify our anger. Any immigrant, whether they are contributing or this is, I oppose this meritocracy-based system. And if we oppose meritocracy, then we need to keep it also in our resistance and our words as part of the resistance. Mm-hmm. We cannot adhere to the idea of meritocracy as an argument against his idea of meritocracy. Yep. Mm-hmm. I think that if you are an immigrant, you have a right to be in this country. We're the great melting pot. We are the great experiment. And yes, that firefighter, may he rest in peace, did something amazing and selfless, and it should be celebrated. But I also think that we should be talking about Haitians coming to America that aren't necessarily firefighters or you know, police officers or people making grand differences, but people that are coming to have a normal life.
And just, and because there's also there are people in this country right now that aren't saving lives. That
yeah.
aren't
and also, doing
this. So, you yeah. know, and how that, discount some how could you discount someone else from coming in here?
Exactly. And also yeah. that particular firefighter, it's like he's not a good firefighter because he is an immigrant. He's a good firefighter because he's a good firefighter.
Yeah.
Right.
And he happens to be an immigrant, you know? So it's like, I totally agree with you, Nick. It is one of those things that let's celebrate it, but let's celebrate it for like the human story in which it is and not like, oh, we can tokenize
it. It's like, oh, look how good this immigrant is.
Look at this black
is.
Guy. Look like, at this, well, you know, Asian person. It's like, it's not point, you know, let's actually be inclusive by inherently being inclusive.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Moving on.
Let's move on to just, I guess, general fuckery. So Congress is going to let CHIPS funding... Congress let CHIPS funding expire 102 days ago, and it's a national disgrace.
This and CHIP, to everyone who's not clear on what that acronym is, is Children's Health Insurance Program.
Yeah, so this is an interesting article by Sarah Cliff at Vox, where she wrote about the Children's Health Insurance Program, which is a cheap, successful program that provides health care coverage to 9 million low- and middle-income children. Its budget expired, 102 days ago. This article's from earlier in the week, so it's been longer. And Republicans in Congress have done next to nothing about it. Multiple states have sent out letters warning families that their kids' health insurance could end on January 31st. Congress did pass a temporary bill that expected to extend CHIP's lifespan until March, but it turns out they got the math wrong, and states may run out of funding as early as January 19th, which is in 5 days. It will be in 4 days by the time you hear this. Democrats and Republicans have agreed in principle on a plan to reauthorize CHIPS funding for 5 years, but Republicans proposed a series of deeply partisan spending cuts to cover the costs of extending CHIP, such as slashing Obamacare programs and Medicare that have stalled negotiations. Senator Orrin Hatch, Republican from Utah and generally awful person, said that the reason CHIP is having trouble passing is because we don't have the money anymore. We just add more and more spending and more and more spending, and you can look at the rest of the bill for the more and more spending. But just days after Hatch said this, Republicans passed tax cuts worth $1.5 trillion that aren't paid for at all. I think that if you are playing politics with the Children's Health Insurance Program, you are a monster. You are a monster. Sorry. Just wanted to... This is absurd that we are playing games.
But isn't it weird that that's not a hot take right now? Like, I think, like, that's not an inflammatory remark. It's true. You're being petty with the lives of children.
Yes.
That's what this comes down to.
Yes.
Yep.
It's a shame that they're adding amendments on and saying you needed to defund Obamacare. Anyway, so if you want to get involved, the United States Capitol switchboard is 202-224-3121. A switchboard operator will connect you directly with the Senate office you request. You can also go to 5calls.org if you want to have a script, or you can text RESIST to 50409, and you can fax your representative to let them know that these, like, draconian laws. Oh, God. Very upsetting.
Yes. So moving on, this is an article that came out earlier this week. Acclaimed booked the book The New Jim Crow, banned in some New Jersey prisons. So this is a book about the discrimination against African-Americans in the criminal justice system, and it's been banned from some prisons in New Jersey, according to new obtained records. So it's an award-winning book by Michelle Alexander, published in 2010. It's appeared on lists of publications that inmates in state correctional facilities may not possess. The ACLU obtained this banned book list in response to public records request and called for the ban to be lifted and said it violated the rights of inmates under the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. So the reason why this is so jarring about New Jersey is because New Jersey has, as of June 26, 2016, they put black residents behind bars 12 times the rate of white residents. So that's already a disparity in how they jail black residents. Now they're being deprived of their right to read, just to read information, to understand. And this book is really clear because Jim Crow, these were a set of laws that basically enforced racial segregation after the Civil War. And so when you're noticing the parallels between that and what's going on in our current prison system, and we talked about it last week with private prisons and things like that. And so now these inmates aren't allowed to read this, as if this was something that was like, oh, we don't want to incite violence from this. We don't want to incite any kind of threat to safety. But no, this is knowledge. This is knowledge that like they're being treated unfairly, or they're being deprived of their, because there's only so much they can do while they're there. And now you're saying they can't do simple things like reading this kind of book. I thought it was just very poignant that we know that these types of things are going on, and the ACLU is working diligently on this case to give them their rights, even though they've been stripped of many of them.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
But there is good news.
There is good news.
Before we jump into our interview.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Before we jump in. Sorry. We recorded our interview before we did this. So I was like, what are we going to do? So the Senate bill to block net neutrality repeal now has 40 co-sponsors. This is from a article from The Hill by Harper Niedig. A Senate bill that would block the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, from repealing its net neutrality rules now has 40 co-sponsors, Senate Democrats announced Tuesday. It appears unlikely that the bill will pass, but Democrats see political value in forcing Republicans to take a stance on the issue. Polls have found that a large majority of the public supports keeping the net neutrality rules. The bill would use authority under the Congressional Review Act, CRA, to block the FCC's repeal from going into effect. And with more than 30 senators on board, the legislation will be able to bypass the committee approval process, and Democrats will be able to force a vote on the floor. When this comes to a vote, we will probably cover it.
Yep.
It is important to remember who votes no on this. This is absurd that a body of five individuals has the right to dictate how we use the internet.
Yep.
This, you know, it already passed. Net neutrality is so important to keeping a free and fluid internet so that giant telecom companies can't charge you for more if you want to experience certain things.
They already charge us too much.
They already charge us too much.
For slow service anyway.
Well, okay. That sounds like a personal... I have great service.
Okay, well, most people don't.
That's true.
And most coffee shops don't either. Anyways, we have two candidates to get excited about. We took a look at that list of retiring Congress people, men and women. And so we thought we'd highlight the 2nd Congressional District in Tennessee because it has not elected a Democrat since before the Civil War.
That's a long time.
Whoa.
Yep.
That's a long time.
That's a long
time. That's a long time, but also more recent than we really think.
I know, because we have a big problem with Civil War leftover items.
Yes, we do.
Yes.
A lot of toys
and by
that
items,
we need to throw
I mean
away.
Actual items, but also concepts. Anywho.
And statues.
So the current Republican, John Duncan Jr., has announced that he's not coming back, and he was preceded by his father, John Duncan Sr. So there are two...
Wait, that's the guy with the photo, right?
Yes.
If you get a chance, don't donate. But really, just check out John Duncan's his website, because the photo they used...
It's
amazing.
Haunt you. It's gonna haunt your dreams.
It's
less
amazing.
About him
I would
and more
frame
about
it
the
if he
two
wasn't such a bad
yes.
person.
Democrats.
Sorry. Yeah.
So there are two Democrats that have currently registered to run, and the filing date is through April 5th. So we might see some more pop up. There's only two Democrats, and I think something like six or seven Republicans that are egging for this district. Mm-hmm. First one is Dr. Joshua Williams, who is a doctor. He's a psychologist, which means, you know, according to his website, it says he's uniquely qualified to build coalitions, which I agree with, and find meaningful consensus and truly represent the interest of people. Mm-hmm. He believes in working families, helping retired leaders, taking a lead on healthcare that creates jobs, keeping people safe, and tackling the opioid heroin crisis that is, you know, rampant in that area and our country, and honest, to be honest. So his name again is Dr. Joshua Williams. He's coming out of Knoxville, Tennessee. And then the second Democrat is Renee Hoyos. And she was the executive director for the Tennessee Clean Water Network. She's currently, she has an interim director in there for her because she's out on the road. And she is also amazing and wonderful.
So and these are hope.
These are two hopeful candidates for that. And area of the country.
And you know, we said the we said that there hasn't been a Democrat in elected in this district since before the Civil War, but I believe in Virginia, didn't they change a lot of things that were going on with who was elected in Virginia? Was it the Attorney General or the Lieutenant General? The Lieutenant Governor. Sorry, I'm frantically looking this up.
Yes, you are.
The Lieutenant Governor of Virginia. Who is the guy that... Justin Fairfax. Ha ha ha.
Okay,
we've landed on it, guys.
Yes. Wasn't he the second African-American elected to high office? He is the second African-American elected statewide in Virginia following Douglas Wilder since the Civil War. So it can happen.
That's right.
Sorry. Wow. That was... Yes. Could not have been a messier end. But I love Justin
But we
Fairfax.
Got there. We got there. And really... if you need a...
Oh, God.
A political... What's... Trivia... partner, Nick is your guy.
Maybe.
The end of this episode is falling apart and I'm loving it.
But we are going into a really exciting interview. So everyone, thank you for listening to the news update. Get up, get out there, get involved, and stick around for
Emiliana Guareca
of the Women's March LA.
We'll see you guys in a second.
Hi, guys. Welcome back. We're very excited. We have Emiliana Guareca. She is the founder of Women's March LA. She's an entrepreneur turned activist and a very inspiring person that we're super excited to talk to. Emiliana, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Can I just say that as someone who attended the Women's March in LA last year, I remember standing there with my roommates looking around being like, I feel like because there are so many people, it's almost like a woman's stand because there like wasn't enough room, and it was like it was unbelievable that the turnout in the first year. And so I thought we would just jump in with, you know, what was your expectation of how it was gonna start, and then, you know, the overwhelming amount of people that came out. What did that feel like as the founder of this section or part of the country?
I was overwhelmed myself. I mean, when I started planning for it, I thought it was just going to be the people in my email list and a few friends on Facebook. And it slowly turned into bigger than what we expected. We expected about 100,000 people. And but it was fantastic. But we felt it growing. The day before when we were, you know, setting up tents by all volunteers, we probably had about 600 people show up and ask what they could do. So we knew that it was going to be bigger than we expected.
And now I want to go back a little bit. And so you started the fund for Women's March back in 2016, correct?
I started the?
You started the fund for the Women's March? Was that
started, the foundation.
The
I
foundation.
Started the foundation, yes. So okay. I started the foundation post-election. Mm-hmm. I started organizing the day after the election. I actually applied for permits to shut down streets in the city of LA the day after the election. Yes.
Okay. So what was going through your head the day after the election? You know, you find out at the same time as the rest of us, Donald Trump is now president. And what was going through your head, and how did it land on, oh, we need to have a solidarity march? How did we get to that point?
So, I and a few friends were, you know, we're talking about how we were devastated. I felt a lot of anxiety. I felt like whomever voted for this administration voted against me. And I knew that we were going to be in trouble. I'm, you know, come from a huge family. We came to the United States illegally. So we've known deportations. We've known not having rights. And so we had anxiety over it. So we decided that we were going to organize our community. And that was the only thought I had. Our community is going to come out and support of us marching in the streets.
And do you think right off the bat that you wanted to plan it for the day after his inauguration?
I started planning right off the bat the day after the inauguration, yes.
Yeah.
As well as D.C., as well as, you know, this was started by a grandmother in Hawaii who said, we need to take to the streets. And so a lot of people felt they should go to D.C. I live in L.A. I felt like L.A. needed something as well, not just D.C., because I firmly believe that, you know, politics start locally and you should be involved locally.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's one of those things. I had the same feeling after the election day, severe anxiety and just being scared for myself and my family and my close friends, such as yourself. Now I consider you a close friend. But so I'm curious. So it did start by the woman in Hawaii. And so how do the chapters throughout the country work with that larger momentum that happened in D.C.?
So we just started organizing ourselves. So I know that in California, we started finding each other via social media. We started weekly phone calls. I mean, I would get on weekly phone calls with California chapters. I would get on calls Wednesday and Thursday nights from November up until the March with anyone in the Midwest. We helped fundraise for Indiana, for Wisconsin marches, an Arkansas march. So we found each other via social media and figure out ways to help each other. Most of these people had never known each other. I know that all of the organizers that are currently still with us in LA, we met each other on social media.
That's amazing. I'm curious about that, sort of this ascent into the movement. Because I was reading an article where you mentioned that you weren't very political pre-Trump. And now this post-Trump world, you've gotten into it so much. And one of the common themes we have for guests on the podcast is them taking the skills that they've honed over their life and then applying that to the resistance and to the movement. So I'm curious how you took your skills as an entrepreneur, as an event planner, and how that lent into the Women's March.
I used all of my skills. I mean, I was a community organizer, not political. I would organize a chili cook-off where I would get 500, 600 people to show up with their chili. So I used that skill to ask people to join me. I used my event planning skills to take out permits and know how to shut down streets and get everyone involved that I need to get involved to have permits. And I think Andina, my co-executive director, used her skills as a producer of a TV show to reach out to stars. Ellen Crafts, who works with us as well, used her skill as a communications director to help us put together, pamphlets and messages. So all of us that came in had a different skill and just applied it.
And first of all, that's amazing. That it came together like that. Now, some of these people that were helping out with the Women's March were people that got involved after the election of Donald Trump. But there's also activists who were involved pre-Trump. And I'm curious what that has been like coordinating with pre-Trump and post-Trump activists and what the atmosphere has been.
That's been a balancing act because I didn't want to take over work that other organizations have been doing for decades. So we invited everyone to join us to participate, and people and organizations that have been doing this type of work joined us. You know, some kind of sat out, didn't know what it was going to be, didn't know if it was going to be safe, and also keeping in mind that we didn't know each other. So for me to come in and ask to an organization to join me for a women's march was insane, to be honest. I couldn't even explain it myself. Like, we're going to march in the streets. This is women's march. I'm Emiliana. And, you know, just honing that messaging is, please join us. We're scared of this administration. We want to make sure that we are all safe. We want to make sure that we are all heard, that this is not okay.
I think that's hilarious. But it's a true representation of how everyone felt. It was like the day after the election, we all went outside and were like, who are our allies? And so I'm curious to hear, it sounds like you forged a lot of partnerships with other organizations that have been doing great work and newer, younger organizations. So how have those relationships changed from last year to this year? And who can we expect to see next weekend at the march?
So from last year to this year, our partnership grew. Our partnership, because we continued the work. We weren't just a march. We were, you know, visiting schools, registering new voters, speaking about, you know, civil rights, because this is another civil rights moment and another civil rights wave, as we think it is. You know, so a lot of organizations are joining us, and our job really is to amplify the work that these other organizations have been doing for years, and they need manpower, woman power to help them. They need volunteers where, you know, we are like, we're just one person. I get hundreds of emails a day of what can I do? And we try to point them out towards organizations that are doing the type of work that people are looking to do.
Yeah. And so now my question about that is, you know, it's like you're saying, there's this entire network that Women's March wants to be. You know, it's more than just the march on one day of the year. Like, we are reaching out, we are trying to send a message. So what is the conversation that Women's March wants to start? And what do you guys want to turn around so that we're all on the same page about the way that women are treated and the way that we should be treating them going forward?
Well, it's not only just about women, it's about minorities. Women are treated as a minority, to be honest. We, you know, so it's about everyone's rights. The message that we're sending out is to use our power of the vote. We as citizens have a choice as to who gets elected, and we need to exercise that. Voter turnout is at an all-time low. Midterm elections, people just don't show up. Mm-hmm. Yet, that is what really affects you. That is what really affects you in your community. You know, or to even think that I'm registered to vote, but I don't think my vote counts. It does count. You're just not making it count.
So
if you're going to sit out, you know, if you're going to sit out of voting, then, you know, we have bigger issues because you're still voting by sitting out. You're just not making it count.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I wanted to talk to you about, you mentioned how it's become sort of this establishment now, and it's, and, you know, you're reaching out and it's growing. We have a march happening next weekend. Does it become a yearly thing as an establishment and as a movement? Is it just a one-off repeat of last year, or do you think that the march will happen every January?
So we are in no way trying to recreate what happened last year. Mm-hmm. What we are trying to do is to continue the conversation. What we're trying to do is to activate people on the power of the vote. That is our goal. Does it become a yearly event? Maybe. We don't know. It may be. But at this point, we fundraise for this particular event, and it's not cheap. For all of our sister chapters to be able to do this, we need to figure something out as a national organization. As of now, we are saying that it probably will happen yearly, but, you know, we don't know. We hope that we do. We hope that we are continuously showing up. We hope that we're continuously asking people to be upstanding citizens, to vote, to be active in their community. The key is being active in your community, going to city council meetings, you know, attending school board meetings, because otherwise, what's going to change? We can't just march. We have to now exercise our power of the vote.
I completely agree. And it's interesting, those two subtle corrections you've given us. First, that women are treated about as a minority and that this march is really about everyone's rights. And second, that you're not trying to recreate from year to year, but rather continue the conversation. Those two subtle but clear intentions, I think, are really exciting and innovative with activism and how we view activism moving forward. So I'm curious, let's just hypothetically, let's say the march happens every year, money is raised, and it grows and change and grows and gets smaller depending upon people's availability. But what are the other kinds of touch points the Women's March is potentially looking at? You know, what are the other ideas circulating?
So for us, it's youth empowerment. That's huge. You know, what are we teaching our little girls, our little boys in the age of this administration? How are they going to move forward? Kids are probably super traumatized by what's going on. They know what's going on. Imagine being an illegal alien right now, an illegal kid, hearing what this administration is putting forth based on your color. So for us, we're putting together youth empowerment forums, and that's key, because that is who is going to continue this, right? So it's, for me, it's empowering those kids from 12 to 17 on how to be an activist in your community, how to stand up for your community and yourself.
Now, are you basing these forums on experiences that you've had as an entrepreneur? You know, these programs that you're putting forward, what kind of advice did you get when you were the same age as these kids?
None. I can tell you that we grew up poor in Chicago. And I remember speaking to a counselor, and that counselor asked me not to fill out an application for college because I could not pay for it.
Yeah,
and that should have never been a conversation that a kid hears, right? It should be like, hey, you have good grades. Let's figure out what's out there for you. I mean, sure, I may not be able to afford, you know, Stanford, but there's community colleges. Let's talk about what you can do instead of what you can't do.
Yes, that is horrifying, what you heard when you were younger. And I'm so thankful that you've had other people along the way to get you to this point. And so I'm curious, within these empowerment forums, are you going to schools? Are you going to community centers, or a mix of the both? How are you getting in the
goodness.
Weeds?
Schools, community centers, people's homes, people open up their homes, their businesses for us to come and talk about, what we're doing, how we're empowering the community. You know, even talking to, you get a different story from a different community. You know, I'm visiting Cal State and speaking on the power of the vote and how they have a chance to change whatever it is they think they were not able to change. And having kids at that school tell me, we don't think our vote counts. We're not going to exercise it. And then speaking at UCLA, and UCLA students are thinking, I don't want to vote. My parents should vote, right? Like, my parents vote. Like, I'm too cool to vote, almost.
Wow.
And yet, everything that's out here is going to affect them for years.
That's wild to think, that sort of, I can't.
Because, like, who is, so have they justified why they think that way? Why it's suddenly an uncool thing to vote, that only older generations do it?
Well, I think that happens all the time. Remember Rock the Vote? We were trying to make voting cool because we're disenfranchised voters. And I think we're at that point again where it's like, hey,
we got to bring P. Diddy back out.
Yeah.
It just seems interesting that, because I think now we do have a new generation coming up that is excited to vote. And I think a lot of that did, kind of similarly to how the Women's March started, was it out of reaction to what they were seeing with Trump's election. You know, there's a generation of kids who weren't eligible to vote at that time, but now they're saying, wow, I can't wait to vote in that next election. To a lot of them, 2018 is their big one. But that's why, you know, we started this podcast to talk about how it's these smaller elections, your city council, you know, your things like that, the people that are like next door to you, that's the reason you need to vote. You need to start at the ground. And you know, you did that with this march. You said, like, okay, fine. Like, I have this set of skills. I'm going to do something in my community that's going to get everyone together. And it just happened to get exponentially bigger than any of us imagined it would get. So with all that momentum, you know, is there any other way that Women's March wants to branch out? Are there more people they want to become in partnership with? What are some other goals of the march?
We do want other organizations to come in partnership with. I think our goals of the march is to get voter turnout, to continue the conversation, as we were saying, but to get these communities involved, to not be disenfranchised, to, you know, some people don't even know that they can vote. They're just like, well, I don't have an ID. What? It's more about education. It's almost a civics 101. I mean, I grew up in the United States, and I had a boyfriend ask me to register to vote. How sad is that?
Yeah.
It was like, Emmy, are you registered to vote? I was like, what? So it's civics 101, and also we're trying to put together mock voting booths for people that are registered to vote and may be intimidated to vote. You know, that's part of it, and also having youth ambassadors that know the voting system, that are learning and are bringing in more people to learn, because that's all it is. I mean, and voting is about to change drastically in LA. The way voting will happen is in voting centers instead of a polling place. And we will be able to vote for 11 days, and you can stop in and vote anywhere within the county.
I'm curious. I want to reverse a little bit to the organization around the Women's March. And, you know, because in Los Angeles, there were a lot of people that showed up, but Los Angeles is also a very liberal space. I'm curious if you've spoken to other organizers in deep red states, because you were talking about voter intimidation and people being affected differently. Is there a different approach to organizing when the march is going to be much smaller, or it's going to be in a potentially dangerous place? Have there been methods that you've learned from them that can be applied to the LA march as well?
Absolutely, yes. So last year we had Bakersfield bring out a ton of buses to LA. And this year, that same group sat with me and were like, well, this is something we need to do in our city. Okay, so we organized. We figured out what their community needed, who to call forth. You know, and people are saying, where are Republicans allowed at this? If you stand for a rally, you should come up, right? Mm-hmm.
That's hilarious.
I mean, there's a contingent of Republican Women for Women's March coming out, and it's just like, okay, you know, we need allies. And it's the same with Fresno. Fresno gets a lot of heat, and, you know, it's just like mom organizing on her own time. And, you know, we're asking her not to take it personal. Not everybody is going to agree with us, but what we do agree is that we all want to be equal.
I love that. I think it's so funny what you just said, you know, about are Republicans allowed at this event? Because, you know, I'm not a Republican, but if I was, I would that would be a thought that crossed my mind. And I think the Women's March priority on the crux of the issue that everyone is equal is really powerful, because then those Republicans will come, and then we actually have a space for conversation around why they believe what they believe, and that's the only way for progress. So that's really exciting you had that question, even though it's kind of a bizarre question, because the march doesn't say only Democrat women.
Because at that point, there is something out there that you think you're missing out on, mm-hmm. right? Because if you're actually paying attention and you're asking, are Republican women allowed? Absolutely, you're allowed. right? Because we need to talk. We need allies. And you are looking for information if you are asking if you could come.
I'm curious, too. You know, last year at the Women's March, there was a lot of talk about men coming to the march and their role in that. And there were some people saying that men shouldn't be there, and then other people saying that men should be there. And there was a big talk this year at the Golden Globes about men not mentioning the Me Too movement. And I was curious, what was that talked about when you were organizing the march? And what were the opinions on that? Is showing solidarity as opposed to being absent?
No, for us, it was, we knew we needed men because we need allies. Again, like, in order for us to change what's going on, we need some people in power, men in power, to say, hey, why aren't we hiring women? You know, why is this going on as well? So in putting together Women's March, there was no thought put into, we don't want men there. I mean, there were groups that came out. There's a group called Men for Women's March, and they organized. They came out to help us. And I'm going to tell you that they sent in funds, fundraising. I mean, Emmy, what do you need? Do you need manpower? You know, and they thought I would be offended by the word manpower. Like, I'm married. I have two boys. I don't have anything against men here.
You're like, we accept both female and male money. Don't worry.
Just no male Republicans. Can't have that. That's where we draw the line.
Yeah. So for us, that was never an issue. What did become an issue was the amount of men that wanted to speak on the stage, that they felt like they needed time on the stage. And there were a few men that tried overshadowing some of our speakers. That was an issue, you know, and we corrected it on the spot. I did have an issue personally with men trying to lead the march. I mean, I had I'm like, okay, no, no. Do that.
That's a hard no to the back.
We have a problem with that. Sorry about that on behalf of men.
That is so funny.
And I took it upon myself to say, I have a problem with that.
Yes.
You know, I don't know how anybody else feels, but I had a problem with that. I was like, this is not your moment.
Yeah.
Let's be back here. Let the women lead this march. Mm-hmm. Let's do that.
Right.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Yes. I also have a problem with that. So thank you for course correcting.
It's really you have audacity to be a man and be like, I want to help lead this march. That's crazy.
The women's march.
That's the level of thinking. That's what goes on. I'm the man. I need to do this. I'm like, no. I think we got it.
But you know, it's so telling though, because look at where the Women's March was, okay, a year ago. And now fast forward a year, we now have the Me Too movement, the Time's Up movement. We've had women speaking out and men as well about sexual assault. And you know, like this, so the sphere has changed just ever so slightly, but we're now like, what an amazing advancement we've had in a year. Are you guys going to pair up at all with Me Too or Time's Up or anything like that? Yeah.
We are in talks about partnership. They are taking, some of them are taking the stage, Time's Up and Me Too. Mm-hmm. The conversation around that for us is that we need to figure out how to bring that movement to our community so it doesn't feel like it's just the STARS movement.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah.
What happens after the glitz and glamour of going on the stage, wearing black and saying Time's Up? How are we going to back this up in our community?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just going to pipe in with my opinion here, but I really, I appreciated the wearing all black and why we wear black and Time's Up. But I kind of also wanted to say, you know, dear all of these wonderful stars who I enjoy your work, why don't you spend half the amount you do on that gorgeous black dress? Because now they all look the same. And donate that to the Women's March, or donate that to, you know, a domestic violence center. It was just,
centers. Yeah, shelters,
I was like, we're still spending a lot of money on a dress for an award show for rich people.
To be fair, fashion designers usually donate those dresses. I agree with what you're saying, the sentiment.
They all should donate.
But,
all
you know.
Yeah. But that's exciting that you're, that, you know, with... I do think that James is onto something here, you know, with the momentum created by your work from the election day through the March and inauguration day in the past year really has, it sparked a lot of other aligning movements, and that's really exciting.
I think it's exciting because women are getting a voice.
Yeah.
Wow.
I think it's exciting that people are stepping up, like, hey, this is not okay, you know? And again, for us, we're in conversation of how does it come down to the communities? Will we support young girls that have been sexually assaulted? How are we doing that? You know, so that's we are speaking about partnership with Me Too and Time's Up to be able to bring it to the ground and not just feel like it's just a hashtag and it's just for Hollywood.
Now, well, first of all, I want to thank you for coming on the podcast because this has been amazing. And we're very excited for the Women's March happening next week. And for all of our listeners, go to it. It's going to be amazing. I guess for our last question is, you know, you got involved after the election of Donald Trump and you used the tools that you had to contribute to this wonderful movement. What would you recommend to somebody listening to this podcast right now about getting involved?
Think of your skill set and how do you want to activate? You know, we had a woman just come out and make tackles and donate all the money to us, you know, where she thought, I only know how to make tacos. That's a fantastic skill, you know? So think of the skill set that you have and how can you help? You know, you may only have 4 hours, but guess what? There's phone banking, right? There's a lot of stuff you can do in a few hours from your own home, you know, throughout the year.
Yeah, that's amazing. Well,
absolutely.
Thank you again so much for coming on. It's been amazing. If you guys want to look up Emiliana Goreca, she's the founder of the Women's March LA, an entrepreneur turned activist. She got involved. You can get involved. If you want to hear more of our stuff, you can check us out. We are We Rebel on Apple Podcasts. You can email us, werebelpodcast@gmail.com.
And then, of course, next weekend, Women's March in downtown Los Angeles starts at 9 a.m. And if you're not in Los Angeles, there's probably an associated march very close to you. So look it up and get out there.
Get out there. Get involved. Thank you so much
for
coming on.
And you're so busy right now. So, yes, thank you.
Thanks for fitting us into your insane last minute scheduling. Get the city to come out and support schedule.
Thank you. Thank you for all your work, too.
Oh, thanks.
Awesome. All right, everyone. We'll see you guys next week.
What's a Creative Podcast Network?
Welcome to the Clam Bake!
I'm Lindsay Stitho.
And I'm Angela Gullner.
It's the opposite of a sausage fest.
Just a bunch of vaginas talking feminism.
You got it. Every Monday.
On What's a Creative.
Stay tuned.
Tune in!